Welcome to A Christian and an Atheist Walk into a Bar. I'm Phil Thompson, and I'm the Christian.
And I'm Neil Newton, and I'm the Atheist.
And Neil, what are you drinking in our virtual bar this week?
I'm not actually. I'm cleaning up the bar today.
Wow.
Because it's 8 a.m. in L.A. And it just feels like a little bit early. It would be okay if I was still drinking from last night. Because last night was Saturday night, but I was asleep by probably about 10 p.m.
So well, it's 11 a.m. in Pittsburgh or thereabouts.
Which is more acceptable.
Which is more acceptable. So I'm going to go ahead and crack this open. I have a Cinderlands Spirit Clean Triple IPA. Yeah, my spirit definitely feels clean after having a sip of this.
Oh, yeah, but do you even have a spirit?
Well, that's what we're talking about today. And tell us why that's such an incredible segue, Neil.
We're talking about dualism today, or as you might say it, dualism.
Is dualism the study of the 90s folk singer-songwriter who made a few movies?
The study of... Well, it's just when anything is split into two, really, or is viewed from two points.
So dualism has come up a few times in previous podcasts, and it was coming up so much and seemed like such an important topic that we thought we would devote an entire episode to dualism, or as Neil says, dualism. So where do we want to start?
I think to keep it relevant... Initially, because we're definitely going to go off topic, I can see. But to keep it relevant, it might be good to start with the idea that dualism is not part of your view of Christianity. You have a very, what is it called when it's not dualism? Monism?
I think we think of it as a holistic reading.
Okay.
And I should specify that my reading of Christianity is non-dualistic, and that's not to say that many predominant readings of Christianity are not dualistic.
The separation between body and spirit seems to be a key, especially like 20th century reading of the Bible, right?
Well, not just 20th century. The argument that I was exposed to, and I'm grateful that I was exposed to this argument, is that the dualism begins to creep in as early as the first century. And it creeps in through Platonic dualism. And I'm going to give a little background here. When I think about dualism and the way I learned about dualism in Christianity and in relation to Christianity and how to think about it was through the Dutch Calvinist 20th century philosopher Herman Dooyeweerd. And Dooyeweerd lays out three dualisms that in his mind kind of control the development of Western culture. And so he starts with Platonic dualism, which is the form-matter dualism, that there's the material world, but there's like a true form behind that material world. And in that form-matter dualism, matter is definitely the inferior part of our experience, and matter is often the barrier to us being fully enlightened and fully aware and spiritual beings.
Sure.
And that's something that we talked about when we were talking about Bart Ehrman's Heaven and Hell. He talks about how that form-matter dualism affects both early Christian ideas of heaven and early Christian ideas about hell. What the Dutch Calvinists in particular have argued is that the Bible itself is not dualistic in that way. When you go to the Genesis story, the creation story, creation is good. After each day of creation, the refrain is, "And it was good." The idea that our material existence is somehow a barrier to us being closer to God or more spiritually awakened is antithetical, certainly, to the Old Testament. Now, it gets tricky in the New Testament because you do have discussion of the spirit and the flesh, and some dualistic language creeps in. But from Genesis to Revelation is always about the redemption of the entire creation and the redemption of our bodies. And this also goes back to something that we were talking about a little bit when we discussed Ehrman's Heaven and Hell, is that the redemption of the body is central. And what Dooyeweerd argued was that the spirit-body dualism, the form-matter dualism, creeps into the church early on by the second century because all of the church fathers, as they're called, were all trained in Neoplatonic philosophy and rhetoric. So
we've moved from Jerusalem to Rome, really, at this point, right?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, that's one of the things that happens. So, Neil, that's kind of how I got started exploring dualism and trying to reject dualistic thinking. How did you get there as an atheist and someone who's really interested in philosophy?
Yeah, a lot of the philosophers I like, I guess you would say that they move away from dualism as an idea. It's still somewhat there, but it's only there as a side effect and not really like an important part of it. Graham Harman is a philosopher I really like, and Graham Harman's whole thing actually is decentering humans altogether, and he's building on phenomenology and this idea, like phenomenology started as a way to get in touch with reality, but it very quickly turns into this thing where the phenomena is created by the mind,
right?
And you never actually get to the object, and it's very much like touching on the dualism that you talk about. The form is away from you, and you're only dealing with your perception of it in some way. And so he was like, well, it started looking for the object, and it very much ended up taking us almost further away from the object. And you know, so he puts together his theories, which get called lots of different things: speculative realism, object-oriented ontology, object-oriented philosophy, you know.
Yeah, object-oriented ontology is the one that I'm most familiar with. And actually,
the same names for the different things, I should say. But yeah.
Yeah, and you introduced me to object-oriented ontology and Graham Harman because there were some similarities to the Dutch Calvinist thought.
Absolutely, and he was a professor in Cairo for some time, and while he was there, and he might even still be there, I'm not totally sure, was introduced to a lot of Muslim theology and things like that. And that actually, even though his research started before that job, it started as part of his PhD where he's looking at Heidegger, he definitely draws on Muslim theology, medieval theology, as a way into his philosophy, even though he mentions that he does not believe in a god. So there's definitely crossovers there. What he's interested in is that you can't ignore the fact, really, that the object is the thing that's causing the perception.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, you know, it's a perception of an object. And sure, we can't perceive the object in its entirety, which is essentially to say we can't know everything about an object. Like the table in front of me, I don't know its future. I don't know when it's going to collapse, when it's going to break down. When I touch it, I touch the physical aspect of it. I don't touch its flammability. There's things that are withdrawn from me. And so in that way, there's a separation between the object and me. I'm not coming fully into contact with the object, but I'm still coming into contact with basically the object that I have access to. So it's more like part of the object is withheld from me rather than there's an idea that I have an object created by my perception. He dances around that a little bit, but I'm not going to get into that. Yeah, so that resonated with me. It's just closer to our interaction with reality. If our perception was too different from reality, we would come into big problems. We would not survive as a species, you know?
Right. Something that we seem to be experimenting with now.
That's right. And he draws on other philosophers, and one is Levinas. We've both read one of his early articles, which is, I think it's called On the Philosophy of Hitlerism.
Yeah, Reflections on Hitlerism, I think.
Yeah. That's like very early, and later on he develops beliefs like further away from that. That is something we both read, and that actually brings it back to religion, right, in some ways. My memory of that, he blames what he sees as a liberal reformation of the church as being something that leads to Hitlerism in some ways. I read the Levinas article some time ago, and my memory of it has shifted over time into my own creation of it.
Well, but let's talk about
a dualistic version, if you will. I think it's written before Hitler comes to power, or maybe very, very early in Hitler's reign. People aren't actually as worried about it as Levinas is. He's Jewish. He has reason to be concerned. My memory of it is that there is something along the lines of he is concerned that identity is becoming too liberal, and you can almost say whatever you are, and the reaction to this is that people double down with blood and soil. As a response to that, they say, this is what I am. I'm my brother, mm-hmm. my soil. Mm-hmm. And that's how I remember it, but that might not be actually how it is. and you have read it more recently, but maybe have also forgotten it.
Yeah, I think I read it this summer when we were talking about it. One of the interesting things he does as a Jewish philosopher is he explores the idea of repentance and forgiveness in Judaism and later Christianity as ways of essentially transcending time, which is really interesting. So time is, in Levinas's construction of it, sort of part of the material world and is unalterable. It's irrevocable. And the introduction of the concept of repentance and forgiveness means that you can, in a sense, go back in time and undo the things that you've done that are damaging and destructive to yourself and others, which is a really interesting take on repentance and forgiveness. And he contrasts it to the Greek notion of the fates, the moira, that you can't escape your fate. And he sees in the Enlightenment, in Enlightenment liberalism, he sees that religious notion of repentance and forgiveness being, and I should say that repentance and forgiveness creates redemption. And what Levinas sees in the Enlightenment is that the notion of redemption is secularized, so that it's rationality that frees us from irrational acts and irrational social and political and economic structures. So it's still, there's still some continuity in that there is this dualism of there's this spiritual awakening either through religion or through enlightenment that is freeing us from materiality, but it's definitely being the kind of spiritual and religious aspect of it is definitely being attenuated by the time we get to the Enlightenment. And then he sees Marxism as the real shift where materiality is transcendent. And that this kind of paves the way for Nazi religion of blood and soil and the emergence of Hitler and racism, because your identity is completely in your materiality. And that kind of corresponds to how Dooyeweerd understands dualisms too. Dooyeweerd never embraces the spirit-matter dualism. Dooyeweerd wants to say that it's our religious conviction that causes us to see the world in particular ways.
So what I kind of remember about that is that the Marxist emphasis on materialism ends up severing materiality from the soul, which is, or the spirit, or which is kind of identity. So there's, it's almost at the start, there's the body and the spirit, but they're together.
Right.
And then through materialism, they become separated and finally severed. And then once it's severed, then all of a sudden, without the spirit, your identity can be anything. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to that is blood and soil.
Right.
What I don't like about what I'm saying is I'm thinking about this in the context of 2021 and Dave Chappelle and things like that. And I sound like I'm making an argument against transgendered people, which is exactly not what I'm doing.
Okay.
You know, because I'm saying if the identity becomes too free and you can define yourself however you want, you leave the door open for Hitlerism. But that is to assume that I just want, for any malicious listeners out there, if we have listeners at all, if we have listeners at all, I hope that they are not malicious listeners. When I talk about creating identity, that would be to assume that people are creating their own identity rather than, I think for transgender people, it's a very much a lived identity, right? So it is built into their person and their experience. So that is not what I'm talking about when I say the identity becomes too free from the,
sure.
the material person.
I think, and this is maybe my reading and based on my experience and based on what we're seeing happening in the US and in Western society as a whole, there are these reactionary right-wing movements cropping up everywhere in the West right now.
Absolutely.
And the way I read what Levinas is saying is that when we resort to identity in blood and soil and material identity, it's for security. It's because the complexities of developing an identity based on these other things like our rationality, our spiritual identity, our need for redemption, to put it in Christian terms, is too difficult.
Exactly. It's an oversimplification. That's right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what's happening, right? Is you get these people like Dave Chappelle or Ricky Gervais or even Jermaine Greer, you know, like even people you wouldn't expect to do this. And they say, well, look at your body. And that's exactly what you are, you know, and that's just so oversimplified.
But it can also be, look at your race. Look at your national identity.
Look at your paycheck. Yeah.
Look at your heritage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Look at your skin color. Exactly. And these are all things that we do, particularly when the world seems unsettled, I think. And that's why we call it reactionary, right? Because when the world seems as unsettled as it does, we look for certainty.
Yes, exactly. And I guess what I'm saying is, in this kind of like holistic view that we share with this kind of anti-dualism, we're not looking to simplify in that way. We're looking at our lived experience, and that the lived experience of a person is very real to them.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out there because I know that's a dangerous path that things like that we're not looking to go down, but in this current climate, people could want to take these arguments down.
Well, right.
And we have to shut the back door to that type of thing.
Yeah. Right, or the front door, as it were. And one of the criticisms of Dutch neo-Calvinism, which I still find a very valuable framework for understanding history and understanding experience, the kinds of philosophical structures that Dooyeweerd was developing in the Netherlands in the pre- and post-World War II eras were used by Dutch Reformed Church and Dutch Reformed philosophers in South Africa to justify apartheid. So it's extremely easy when you start looking at, well, what are the structures of creation, to come up with overly rigid structures that then are used to justify all manner of oppression. And in the case of apartheid, you have Dutch Calvinists justifying racism and oppression despite the many, many passages of scripture that undermine that quite directly. but they were using this very complicated system of looking at creational structures to do that. And that's actually one of the reasons why I'm really interested in Graham Harman. This might seem like a tangent, but and it may be, but it may not be as well.
This whole podcast's a tangent.
It's kind of a tangent. We should just call this tangents. But whereas Dooyeweerd's philosophy includes understanding our experience of creation in terms of modalities, beginning with the most basic ideas of number and quantity. And then building on those till we get to the aesthetic sphere, not like Maslow's hierarchy of needs or something like that, but in the sense of the lower modalities are foundational to the modalities, not that one is more important. He does see everything as integrated, but in the quest to define these specific modalities, it does create this possibility of things becoming too rigid and too fixed.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about Graham Harman is he has these objects and it's much more fluid. It's like the microphone I'm speaking into is an object, but our conversation is also an object.
Exactly.
The moment in time in which we're having this conversation is an object. So there is this external world, but object-oriented ontology is a much more fluid way of understanding it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what I make maybe break down there is Harman's view of an object, like to go back to the table, which is a common example. And I think because it's generally just in front of a person when they're writing or talking. So it comes to mind a lot, is a table is an object, but a table has a tabletop and table legs. And they are also objects. So an object can be made up of multiple objects. And the reason it becomes an object is it has a surplus. A tabletop with table legs, so the whole table together, can do things that the individual parts can't. So that's the idea of the object, as it has a surplus that its constituent parts don't have. And that kind of gives us fluidity. But what that means is that you can't describe an object by its constituent parts.
Right.
Like you can't break something down and say, like, these are all the bits. We know what all the bits are, therefore we know what the object is.
You know? Right.
You know, that you have to look at the object as it is. And he has the two concepts of undermining and overmining. And undermining is what we're talking about, is when you break something down into smaller parts and then you miss the surplus, the whole picture. I'm actually at the moment reading Douglas Hofstadter's I Am a Sophisticated Loop, which is a book on consciousness. And he talks about the brain, about this, where neuroscience falls into the problem of looking at brain cells and things like that. And he's like, well, really, the brain is an organism that's working together, or an organ, perhaps. I don't know what to call it. an object. An object that's working as a whole. And if you break it down into single little parts, little brain cells, you're going to miss the point. And then the other one, overmining, is when you just look at the relationships of something. Like, you can look at the table and you can say, a table holds stuff. I considered it. I can work at it. So you're just looking at basically what the table does.
Right.
And then if it starts doing different things, it's no longer a table, right? So you lose the sense of object permanence in a way. If you start to define things by relationships, they become perhaps too rigidly defined and you lose that fluidity. One of his points is actually that undermining and overmining is just how humans create knowledge. They're not bad things. That's just how we create knowledge. But what we don't want to do is replace the table with our knowledge of the table. You know, you want to remember that there is still a table there.
This is brilliant and insightful. We should probably talk about why it matters and how we see it happening, how we see dualism emerging in very kind of concrete ways, and I think surprising ways. I mentioned Dooyeweerd's ground motives. Basically, he had three of them. He had the Platonic form dualism that we've already talked about, and then he views the emergence of Christendom as embodying the nature grace dualism. So there's the material world, and there's the world of grace replaces the form pole of the Platonic dualism. Then in the Enlightenment, he talks about the nature freedom dualism, which I and all of these things I think echo Levinas. And the nature freedom dualism is probably the one that, honestly, if we think about it, we're still living in.
Can you break that one down?
Yeah. So by the time we get to, say, the 19th century, we think of the emergence of what we often call romanticism in art and music and literature. But I think it could best be understood as hyper-individualism, or at least better be understood as hyper-individualism. Because what Western society is confronting is the success of the scientific revolution and the notion that the world is essentially mechanical and predictable. And at that point, we're benefiting from the predictability of the world and of our experience. But then it creates this nagging question: are we also just part of the machine?
Yeah, sure. So I know people have this, which I have to say I dislike this idea immensely, but this very determinist idea that we're basically just sacks of chemicals and things, and once we're put in motion, we will do what we do. Essentially, like, there's no free will. There is just this kind of like overdetermined scientific world where we do everything.
Right.
A view that totally ignores quantum mechanics, by the way. But
So do we have any agency, or is free will just an illusion? And what I am calling hyper-individualism is the idea that we assert our agency against the kind of backdrop of what seems to be a completely mechanistic universe.
And
we do that through things like art and music. So in Beethoven is sort of the first romantic composer, right? He's transitional between what we think of as classical and romanticism. But he creates his creative identity by breaking rules. And he's really the first composer who's creating his creative identity by breaking rules.
Sure.
And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you hear a massive difference between the First Symphony and the Ninth Symphony.
Yeah, and we should say he's definitely not the first composer to break rules. But this is like a societal understanding of Beethoven, right? Is that he creates a societal identity by being seen as the first person to break rules in a way, right?
Yeah. That's probably a better way of seeing it. So one of the questions is, when we talk about, say, Dooyeweerd's ground motors or Levinas talking about these relationships between spirit and materiality, do historians buy these kinds of large meta-narratives? And I think the answer is probably not. Historians, at least in this time, want to focus on the particularities and not create large sort of historical meta-narratives. But I would argue that artists do buy into these large of meta-narratives.
And the society in general, I think, buys into large meta-narratives. Like, how many articles were written about millennials and now about Gen Z, right? Idea that an entire generation follows a narrative is incredibly popular. And I'm right on the cusp of being a millennial, being an old millennial.
The elder millennial.
Yeah, exactly. Or younger Gen X. So it's like millennials have a shared lived experience that they have been through certain historical events together, but it does not mean that they are the same.
No, not in any sense. Yeah. And I can think of several examples in art. Like, to me, the idea of the nature freedom dualism is embodied perhaps best by Terry Gilliam's movie Brazil.
I haven't seen this since I was a teenager, so you're going to have to.
So it's a 1985 movie by Terry Gilliam, and 1984 was a big moment where we thought about George Orwell's novel 1984, and Terry Gilliam's Brazil comes out around the same time. It's a dystopian society. The main character, Sam Lowry, is a low-level bureaucrat in this completely authoritarian society that's controlled by this completely inefficient, centralized bureaucracy. And he has dreams. In his dreams, he is a hero in shining armor and wings, and he flies, and his mission is to save this damsel in distress that actually the a woman who looks exactly like the woman in his dreams comes into play in the plot of the story. The difference between Sam Lowry's dreams as being this heroic figure and his day-to-day life as a low-level bureaucrat who is coming to realization that he's participating in this really oppressive authoritarian regime kind of embodies that nature determinism or nature freedom dualism in a lot of ways. Like, it's right there. That is the kind of the core skeleton of Gilliam's movie. So these dualisms, these sort of large meta-narratives and based around dualisms definitely comes up in the arts.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this kind of gets an interesting thing, because one of the things that there's another philosopher, I think he's actually an English professor, who falls into the kind of speculative realism camp is Timothy Morton. And he's become like a famous intellectual. He's looking at not nature freedom, but it relates to that. He's looking at the kind of human nature kind of thing. And he doesn't like when people talk about the natural world as like a separated thing, because he's like, we are part of the natural world. Like,
exactly.
Know, to,
yeah.
You know, like to separate it is to misunderstand ecology, is kind of basically his point.
Yeah, very much so.
Within what he's has a problem with is that we see ourselves as independent from nature, and that kind of evolves, I guess, like you're saying, like this kind of freedom to not be nature. I definitely believe we have free will, but I believe that chaos is at the center of the universe. You know, I think if we get far enough down, it's randomness, it's not mechanistic, you know. It's like we manage to get this mid-level that we're dealing with as humans, which does reliably operate in a mechanistic view. But like, if you were to get down smaller, you would find just chaos, I think, at the base of it.
I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I do think, and maybe it's just a characteristic of the human experience, that we tend to try to express it in these dualistic ways.
Well, I noticed when we're just talking, even though neither of us subscribe to it, we still need to bring up dualistic modes of expression while we talk about it.
Right.
And it's because, like, to some degree, we're so heavily trained in it,
that
we talk about Beethoven as the person and the public reception of Beethoven kind of thing. So we see those as connected, but really they're two different objects, I guess, is one thing to think about it. Like, you know, because the public reception of Beethoven is this societal creation that a lot of people subscribe to, but it can act totally independent of the real Beethoven in many ways.
Right.
Maybe Shakespeare is an even better example, right? Because we know so little about the real Shakespeare.
Right.
Yeah, that I think, like, this is a person who signed his name three times and each time signed it with a different spelling, you know? So there's so little there that the public reception of Shakespeare, the object that we believe Shakespeare to be, is so independent from the real Shakespeare that you might as well not consider them to be related at all. There's not a dualism. There's the person, and then there's just this creation. And then there's arguments about the person because of that lack of information. Yeah.
I think it's very easy in a popular level to just sort of be an unreflective materialist. In that sense, it is, because materialism as a philosophical framework has become so prevalent. And in our public discussion, a lot of times what is permissible is the materialistic, data-oriented discussion of the GDP and employment and unemployment and inflation and those sorts of things. And when non-materialistic religious or philosophical conversation does get in, it's almost always terrifying. It's almost always like the Lauren Boebert or Ted Cruz kind of invocation of religion. So there is this kind of default materialism in the society, but then it creates this tension because I think, I guess what maybe drives us towards the dualism is this nagging feeling that there is more.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that kind of happens, like you mentioned inflation being this thing, and if you just deal with it as a thing, then if you don't view it in its larger context, you run into problems with inflation, right? Because like you're saying, it's like an over-materialism, like almost like inflation is an independent object, which it has no links to other objects. You know, that's one of the things about objects is they do interact with other objects.
Yeah, right, indeed.
You know, so like you can look at inflation, if you separate it too much, you just say it's a figure and it's going in the, like at the moment, there's a lot of criticism of Biden, perhaps because inflation is going in the wrong direction. But if you were to look, say, well, how does inflation relate to things? How do we come up with this number? Because it's a human created number. It's not just like a number that's floating out there in the wild. You go, well, gas prices are a big part of inflation, and the US doesn't actually control gas prices. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah,
and you go, well, also there was a pandemic and we have this massive supply chain shortage. LA, as we speak, has generally there is no ships just floating in the harbor. Whenever one comes in, a container ship comes in, they can just unload their stuff. Like I think before the pandemic, the highest number of ships that ever had waiting in a queue to come in was 9, and currently there's 78 ships waiting. Wow. You know, like just waiting there, like so ships are waiting for months, and this drives up prices.
Yeah.
And this is very much supply chain and pandemic related, and there are things, again, there are things that America has no control over.
Right.
You know, so you can go like, yeah, inflation is going in the wrong direction, but you have to understand like where we get these inflation numbers from. This over-materialism just almost sees the inflation number as like material, right? Rather than being a signpost, a data point really that's collected from a lot of other data points. And you have to know what it's feeding from to know whether it's actually, you know, like a policy fault or not.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're talking about the casual materialist aspect of it, but sometimes the classic dualisms raise their head. And I'm going to bring in what is, I know your favorite band, Neil, Tool. but I rather like them, as I do most prog rock, especially if it has a lot of heavily distorted guitars in it. When Tool's most recent album, the one that they waited, 19 or 20 years to release, Fear Inoculum, they have a song called Pneuma, Pneuma means spirit or breath. And it is classically dualistic. It is spirit-body dualism in an almost classically Gnostic sense. So just here's a sample of the lyrics. We are spirit, bound to this flesh. We go round 1 foot nailed down, but bound to reach out and beyond this flesh become pneuma. So the idea, you have 1 foot nailed down because you're trapped in this physical existence, is sort of the quintessential Platonic and later Gnostic dualism. And here it is in like, what was that, 2019 release by a legendary prog rock, prog grunge band. What would you call them?
I would call them boring, but
– Well, it's the best song on the album musically, I think. And I mean, I think it's a good album. What's fascinating to me about it is just how dualistic the lyrics are.
I remember you sending me through the lyrics too, and there's also like that very Gnostic thing in there of, I can't remember the lyrics off the top of my head at all, but that kind of like this shared light amongst all people or something. Like,
right. We are born of one breath, one word.
Yeah, that's right.
We are all one spark, sun becoming. Child, wake up. Child, release the light. Wake up now, child. Wake up, child. Release the light. Wake up now, child.
Incredibly Gnostic.
It's just like, it's pure Gnostic. And maybe that's what they're going for. I assume that's what they're going for, is that like, hey, the answer is Gnosticism. And that's really interesting to me as a Christian, because as we've talked about in some of the previous podcasts, the effort of the early church to fight Gnosticism is apparent throughout the New Testament. Whether it's Paul in Colossians saying that Christ is the maker of all things and the redeemer of all things, and all things are reconciled to God through Christ. And it's a comprehensive list. Everything in the creation is reconciled to God through Christ. Very important debunking of Gnosticism. The same in the epistles of John, where if you don't recognize that Jesus Christ is died and raised and was fully human and it was raised in a physical body, then he describes it as the spirit of Antichrist. So it's this big fight against Gnosticism in the early church, and it's such a difficult battle because, as I was saying, dualism creeps, especially the spirit-body dualism, creeps back into the church very early on through the church fathers. And the only thing that kind of keeps them on the rails is the theology of the incarnation, that Jesus is born as a human being, of a human mother, even though God is his father. I heard Cornel West say it very well. Many years ago, I heard him lecture in Pittsburgh when his book Race Matters came out. And the way he put it, I'll never forget, he said that Jesus comes into the world between urine and feces like every other person.
That's a very Cornel West thing. and that's the importance of it, right? The Greeks liked their gods to come from like grand backgrounds. Like the point was that you couldn't be a god. one of the things that happens with Jesus is he's born to a carpenter in a manger, and you know, he's basically born homeless, right? You know,
right.
It's flipping things in the absolute opposite direction. Even from my atheist point of view, it's like that's surely has to be one of the aspects of Christianity that has given it so much longevity, is based around the everyman.
Yeah.
It has everyman at its source, I should say. Yeah.
Right. And also been one of the greatest sources of tension, because that's the part of Christianity that is the hardest to embrace. It's interesting that one of the precursors to the Reformation is Julian of Norwich's Showings. Julian of Norwich was an English abbess in the 13th century.
Norwich.
She had, in the midst of a severe illness, she had these visions of Christ and of the Virgin Mary. And her vision of the Virgin Mary is so different from the Catholic vision of the Queen of Heaven, because she sees Mary as a peasant. And we think of that as more modern reclamation of the historical reality of who Mary would be. But Julian understands Mary to be a simple peasant girl in her 13th century vision. And that's part of what inspires Luther. He was very influenced by Julian of Norwich. So it's very hard to stay in the groundedness and the earthiness of Christianity. And biblical Christianity, as I'm reading it, and I'm not alone. I didn't invent this, obviously, but there's a strong framework for an earthy, holistic reading of both the Old and New Testaments, and it's really hard to stay there.
Exactly. There's been different things pulling against it throughout history, because I'm sure once Rome became Christian, they would prefer that Christ was like an emperor. Then this is repeated multiple times, and now we have in capitalism, there's a lot of people who think, well, you know, if he's great, he must have been rich. You know, like,
Right. And again, boy, the gymnastics you have to do to get to that.
Absolutely.
Based on reading the Gospels is just mind-boggling. But
it's not based on the Gospels or anything.
Well, no.
It's based on them going, well, the people I respect are rich, and I respect Jesus Christ, therefore, you know.
It's
a little bit of just a thinking fallacy. Yeah.
That's a thinking fallacy, that's for sure. When I think, too, of dualism and Platonic dualism in particular, I actually think of the internet. Because I think in a lot of ways, the internet, you know, you and I are talking and we're looking at each other on screens. Mm-hmm. And it's almost...
What, this isn't a bar?
Well, since you're not drinking today, no. since you're not having breakfast beer.
And stout is a good breakfast beer.
Stout is a good breakfast beer. Very high in carbohydrates. But I think of the internet because... In a lot of ways, even before the pandemic, the internet was in some ways the ultimate expression of disembodied communication.
Absolutely.
And what we discovered, if you think about the comments on the tweet, what we discovered through the internet is that disembodied communication is absolutely horrible.
It is. I mean, occasionally it pops up, homeless people get killed because someone just wanted to see what it was like to kill someone. And they thought killing a homeless person would have no consequences, you know, just terrible reasoning. The internet is like that on a small scale where people are like, if a disembodied version of me attacks through words a disembodied version of someone else, it's fine.
Like, yeah.
You know, like it has no consequences. It's like, no, there's still a person at the other end of that.
Right. Yeah. And I think the quarantine has driven this home for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Who wants to be on a Zoom meeting at this point? Strides that have been made in video conferencing are going to be beneficial to us for a long time. And we're doing it right now while we're having this conversation. This whole conversation is based on video conferencing, and it probably wouldn't have begun outside of the pandemic. But the flip side of that is a lot of people have realized just how important face-to-face communication and physical contact and physical proximity are to really engaging with other people. I've noticed this at work. We've had a lot of fluctuations in terms of personnel leaving, and we had an early retirement program. So a lot of longtime employees left and a lot of institutional knowledge. There were a lot of shifts in who was doing what job. And what I found was that if you already had a personal face-to-face relationship with the person you were working with, you could collaborate online perfectly well. But if you had never met the person face-to-face and did not have that physical proximity as a foundation for your working relationship, then things would go south really quickly.
That's interesting. What I'm thinking, though, is that this will be to do with the structure of academic department, is that the proper work hasn't been put in to create the online working experience. Because I started a new job during the pandemic. I've only worked with these people digitally. And some of them I work with really well and get along very well. In fact, most of them, when it comes down to it, and during the pandemic, the company moved to be 100% remote, and other people have started during the pandemic who have never met anyone. But there's effort has been put in to creating those things. Like, obviously, we got to know each other having offices next door to each other and just kind of like popping over to the other person's office saying hi, talking shit, going back to our office and working. And that was a key part to that. So I still try to maintain that type of thing working remote. Like, you know, I'll have conversations with people which are not work-based, just jump on a call with them, have a chat about something for, you know, then carry on with work. And yeah, I can see how an academic department wouldn't do that, but you can put effort into getting a face-to-face type relationship. Well, as possible.
Yeah. And as you say that, it makes sense to me. And I think partly is your awareness of there needing to be something besides just like, oh, we're working on this common task.
Exactly. Because one of the things that remote work does is it can be like, we are on this call to talk about this thing we're trying to do. Then once we're finished talking about it, the call is over. You know, like there's this inhuman efficiency built into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make time for other things, which people will not expect. But you have to.
Well, you have to build in human inefficiency.
Yeah, exactly. Because human inefficiency is what saves us from fascism, Phil.
I agree completely. So why is this all important?
So for me, it comes back to my perhaps misremembering of the Levinas, which is that you run into problems, and this is becoming very obvious with fascist movements that are popping up more and more now, is you run into problems when you separate reality from things. And that's not to go hyper-materialism, because obviously we need to interpret reality, but we're at a point where there's a lot of room to maneuver. This will come out later than when we recorded it, but we're like a couple of days after the Kyle Rittenhouse
verdict.
There's two very different stories that are told about that. Anyone who's listened to any of our podcasts will know what side we're full on this.
Yeah.
But you don't need to even mention a side just to point out the divorce from reality that narratives can take, you know, and how damaging that can be.
Well, and also the quest for security, right? And and the reemergence of a religion of blood and soil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, back to Levinas. That's right. We are back to blood and soil, and it's
we're clearly back to blood and soil. And my thought about the Rittenhouse verdict was that we need to stop being surprised when really obvious evil comes from seemingly, you know, inconspicuous places. I on Twitter, I follow the Auschwitz Memorial Twitter feed. And one of the photos that they tweet out from time to time is a photo of these happy young people enjoying an afternoon lunch break, picnic kind of a thing. They're laughing, they're smiling, they're young, they look vibrant. They look happy, and they are the staff at Auschwitz, you know? So, you know, we've got to stop being surprised that immense evil is being perpetrated by people who enjoy a nice picnic with each other and love their dogs and take care of their families and root for the home team.
In fact, I should say, not only should we not be surprised that evil comes from these unexpected places, we should be thankful that it does. Because if evil only came from expected places, like if someone looked like a killer or something like that, then we would just that is a path to fascism. That is a path to saying this person, they've done nothing, but they look like a killer. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, that is the path to the police stopping black people because they're black and things like that. You know, and the fact that it can come from anywhere means that you can't do that, and that is good.
Right. Or we should not do that.
We should not do that.
We do exactly. do that, you know, and I don't think we should be surprised. You know, there's a
That's right. I shouldn't say we can't do it because they do it.
Yeah, we do it all the time, but we shouldn't do it. And we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, the laws of the United States are that we're tried before a jury of our peers. So if you're a white supremacist being tried before a jury and a judge of white supremacists, guess what?
Yeah.
There should not be any surprise there. And in fact, these kinds of verdicts and these kinds of being acquitted of what should be obviously considered a murder happened all the time in the South. Mm-hmm, and still happen.
Yeah.
In actually one of our most recent episodes, episode 7, we talked about the George Floyd trial and mm-hmm. the conviction of Derek Chauvin, which was in many ways an anomaly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And it was, yeah. Anyway, I won't go back into what we probably said there.
Yeah, but it's... The dualism we're retreating into in many ways, and the irony is why it's important to me is that the sad irony is that the retreat into the religion of blood and soil is being led in many ways by white evangelicals in this country.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that is heartbreaking to me for a lot of reasons, not least of which is that it is so damaging to the actual biblical gospel of Jesus and who he is and who Jesus is for. And this emerges in so many ways from a dualistic framework of spirituality in the evangelical world. Everything was about our spiritual relationship with Jesus, our personal relationship with Jesus. There was so little talk when I was growing up, when I was younger anyway, of engagement with society, of being part of God's world in constructive ways. It was all about kind of a spiritual feeling, an emotional reaction to the story of the gospel and the story of redemption. And in some ways, it left Christianity in this culture, at least the white evangelical version of it, completely unprepared to deal with the world as it is.
Yeah.
And so when evangelicals begin to engage the world, it's from an almost comically naive sense of what the world is like. And yet the comedy ends when the result is the reemergence of white nationalism.
Yeah. What I see is wrong with dualism is this kind of ability for people to create this kind of fake story around things, this narrative. And it sounds like I'm leading heavily into materialism, but I think I just found a quote from Graham Harman, which I think will actually clear up what I'm saying, actually, which is, he says, the true danger to thought is not relativism, but idealism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I'm not arguing against relativism. I'm arguing against idealism.
Yeah. As I'm trying to pursue a holistic understanding, which I would argue vehemently is a more biblical understanding of Christianity.
Yeah.
The reason I'm doing it is because I feel like it helps me to be engaged in God's world in creative and constructive ways. And without regard for whether someone is part of my shared faith.
Exactly. Yeah. A big theme in the Bible, regardless of which testament, is that the earth is God's creation, right?
Absolutely.
Like, so to draw too much into the spiritual for a Christian would seem to me to be to ignore God's creation.
This is precisely the problem. If you see creation as God's, even in the midst of the fall, right? You know, we've talked about this before, the Isaiah 60 notion of the redemption of the entire creation and how the ships of Tarshish are there and the camels of Midian are there, even though they are cultural artifacts from outside the covenant community, they still reflect a faithful response to the call to bear God's image in the creation because of the mm-hmm. skill, because of the quality, because of the creativity. So if you are engaged with creation as God's and as the realm in which we express our faithfulness, there are as many ways to serve God as there are aspects of creation. And that was Duyverd's great insight. And that was, you know, that's the best part of the reformational movement, to say that we can serve God in every aspect of our lives, that it's not just doing church stuff, it's not just doing evangelism, whatever that means, but it's pursuing life-affirming work in all the different aspects of mm-hmm. our experience.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. This ties in very, very much to atheism. To when I say atheism, it's non-religion.
Yeah,
as a thing, because I think as we've covered, I don't really agree with the atheist pinup boys. But there's this thing is that you can't deny what we're born into in a way. Without God, there's an easy path to nihilism where you say, well, this doesn't matter. I'm just going to die and nothing's important. And
right, the Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah, why bother about anything? Exactly. And as she points out, we exist and you can't deny that. So deal with it.
Yeah.
That was her exact, that's an exact quote. Deal with it.
I like it.